Okay, so I'm going to talk about life or death decisions. What I'm going to talk about is our work that's directed at trying to understand the network of protein functions involved in controlling a critical decision that's made by cells in virtually all multicellular organisms, and that is the decision as to whether to live or to die. And I'll give you a little bit of background on this. So the process of cell death, known of course as apoptosis, is critical throughout the biological world. It's very important in morphogenesis for creating shapes. The classic example, the webs between one's fingers are eliminated by apoptosis. It's critically important in sculpting the immune system and as well the nervous system. The way both of those systems are put together, at least in vertebrates, is an organism produces a very large number of cells with some degree of randomness in there. And only those cells that are performing properly, for example, in the immune system or in the nervous system, are told to survive. All the rest of the cells are killed off. And for example, in the nervous system, fully 90% of the cells that are created during embryonic development are eliminated by this process of programmed cell suicide or apoptosis. Apoptosis also is medically important. One of the most important cellular processes, I think, in medicine, along with various cell physiology processes and, of course, cell division. And this relates to two different aspects of apoptotic control. If apoptosis is inactive, this is a very serious problem. We must have cells commit suicide when they need to because they do this as a defensive measure to eliminate harmful cells. And so there are a large number of diseases associated with the inappropriate apoptosis, most strikingly cancer. Many cancers, perhaps all, and maybe we can debate that a little bit, have underlying them a problem with committing suicide. The reason the cell became a tumor was because it overrode the signals that it would normally get to commit suicide. Of course, one of those very important signals being relayed through the protein P53, which Arnie discovered and has spent much of his career working on. And in other diseases, I won't go through these, inactive apoptosis also underlies those diseases. It appears to be the case, that all of our cells, I believe this is true, all of our cells are loaded up with most of the machinery required to kill those cells. And so every cell is sort of walking a tightrope there, in as much as it's important to have the apoptotic program armed and ready to go if there's reason to kill the cell off, for example, a virus has infected that cell. But as well, critically important that one keeps that machinery inactive in cells that should survive. There are a number of diseases which are defective in that inactivation of the apoptotic program. So these are diseases associated with hyperactivated apoptosis. In particular, neurodegenerative diseases. Many neurodegenerative diseases appear to be the result of hyperactive apoptosis. Apoptosis occurring in cells that should survive and function for the patient, the human. And there are many other diseases that are the result of or cause, lead to, overactive apoptosis. Heart attack and stroke is another clear case where a lot of the damage that ensues after a heart attack or stroke is the result of activation of the apoptotic program when tissue that's been starved for oxygen has oxygen reintroduced into it. And that actually triggers, for reasons we don't quite understand, the apoptotic program and therefore widespread tissue damage. Okay, so we're actually carrying out our studies on apoptosis, and in fact everything in my lab, using our favorite organism, second favorite organism here, C. elegans. And I want to talk to you, now, I don't, Boris, how much background should I give on C. elegans, et cetera, et cetera? Should I skip over this or go through it?
A little bit.
A little bit, okay. So we find this attractive, actually I've never said this to a number of people in this room, we find an attractive system to study problems of developmental switches and the switch for apoptosis. But in particular, I think of this as a really ideal system for attacking problems of systems biology. In many ways, this experimental organism, seems to me, is sort of just set up, poised to attack through systems biology approaches. And so I want to give you a little bit of flavor for that and show you how we're starting to take a systems approach to these problems. So what is it about C. elegans that makes it attractive for systems biology? Well, first of all, C. elegans was developed as a system by Sidney Brenner in a way to do very rapid classical genetics, and we're now sort of thinking of that on a system scale. On another thing on a system scale is that we have a complete description of the biology of this animal in terms of its anatomy. Its cellular anatomy has been dissected at electron microscopic resolution. So we know essentially the pattern of all the cells in the animal, not at this resolution, but instead at this resolution. John White, working at the MRC, reconstructed the entire structure of the animal, including the entire nervous system, by performing serial section electron micrograph analysis of the animal and then reconstructing those serial sections into a coherent picture of the whole anatomy of this animal. And the outcome of that is that for every single cell in this animal, and particularly important for every single neuron in this animal, we have a complete map of its structure and its relationship to other cells in the animal. And so, for example, because of the reconstruction of the nervous system, we now know of the 10,000 or more synapses that connect all of the neurons in the nervous system of this animal. We don't have this level of information for any other animal in terms of its completeness. We have maps of the structure of the neurons as shown here for every single one of the neurons. And we have, just from that analysis, wiring diagrams of lots of the processes, the circuits that control a number of behaviors, a number of responses in this animal because of that reconstruction. And so that provides a great framework for understanding the nervous system from a system standpoint. And many people are working on it, of course. This, for example, is a little network that's been worked out through a combination of reconstruction, anatomical reconstruction, and also experimental analysis, genetic and experimental analysis where one can use a laser, for example, to kill individual cells. And this relates the thermosensation pathway, thermosensors, sensory neurons, to an ultimate motor output, as it's been worked out in this animal. And we can do this with essentially any neural circuit in this animal. We're poised to do that with this background of information.
So does it mean that there is some database which has some gigantic matrix?
Yeah. You can look up all of this.
Who is connected to who?
Yep. Yeah, so
there's another database which gives coordinates of these cells and coordinates of the name. You know, how is this reconstruction of
It is now, and I think it's continuing to be assembled in terms of precise coordinates, but there's certainly a map of all the neurons and all of the connections made between all the neurons. That's all available online, actually. So there is a very useful database that you can go into and look each one of these up. Okay. Another thing that's really attractive from a system standpoint, particularly one is the developmental biology, is this is the only animal for which we have a complete description of its development at single cell resolution. And that is to say, we have for this animal a description of the cell lineage starting from a fertilized egg and going to a 1,000 cell, 959 cell adult. That's 959 somatic cells with another few thousand germline cells that are present in this animal. For all of the somatic cells, the complete cell lineage, a description of the fate map, that is the pattern of precursor cells that give rise ultimately to cells of differentiated fate, have been completely worked out. So this is the cell lineage of this animal. All of these cell divisions going from 1 to 959 cells occur over a period of just about 3 days, 2.5 days or so. And because of this wonderful description of the development, we know where every cell comes from. We know at any point in development exactly what each cell will become and from whence it came. And that work was largely the effort of John Sulston, who shared the Nobel Prize in 2002 for the efforts on this organism. The ones that don't have a branch means they don't divide anymore. So if you counted all the ones
that... in the middle of where you're branching down, you have these branches where one doesn't go anywhere.
That one? It's the same thing. That's a non-dividing cell. That cell lives. Nothing happens to it after that. It grows, but it doesn't divide. That's just the way the cell lineage starts to grow. Otherwise, you'd have lines all over the place. Wherever you see a lineage terminate like that, that means that is one of those 959 cells present in the adult.
Is apoptosis marked here?
Not at this resolution, but I'll show you later where it's marked. So you can see where every cell death occurs for sure. But you can't see in this lineage chart where cells fuse. Many cells, and actually Kenji Kantani, a postdoc in my lab, has been studying this process, many cells actually undergo cell fusion to create So some of these cells that just terminate like this will actually join together and make a much larger cell, a syncytial cell. That's not shown in the lineage, but we have a description of all of that information as well. Okay, this is the first animal, actually, for which we had available a complete genome sequence, and I think it's the only animal for which we know the complete genome sequence at this resolution. One base pair, it has 100,258,171 base pairs. I don't think we can say that with any other animal, big deal, but, so that means we had a long time to work with the genome. And from that genome, we recognize a lot of proteins that are involved in processes in humans that are relevant to lots of biology, including lots of disease processes.
Is the sequence really complete in the centromeric sequence?
Right down to, so there's no centromeres in C. elegans. C. elegans are what are called holocentric, which means any piece of DNA acts as if it has centromere activity. This is useful to experimenters because if you inject lambda DNA or SV40 or whatever into C. elegans, you will get a mini chromosome that is moderately faithfully maintained. But yes, every nucleotide has been sequenced, so it's claimed, in this animal. It's not probably 100% accurate, but it's about 99.99% accurate. Okay, so what do you do with all this sequence? Well, the other very attractive feature about this animal now, which Sidney Brenner, I'm sure, couldn't have anticipated, is the fact that it's possible to do very large-scale and high-throughput functional genomics on this animal. That is, to ask what the function of each of the 20,000 or so genes is by relating their function to a particular phenotype. That is, to eliminate or lower the activity of each one of those genes and ask how that affects the biology of the animal. And that large-scale, high-throughput functional genomics, which I don't think can be applied to any other experimental, any other animal system anyway, at least across a whole organism, is the result of some developments over the last 8 years, particularly the last few years, in which the process of RNAi, which was discovered, I can't remember now, what is it, 7 years ago or so, allows one to do this. RNAi is the process in which one can knock down or eliminate the function of gene of a gene simply by administering or delivering to cells a double-stranded RNA corresponding to the sequence of that particular gene. So a double-stranded RNA activates this machinery that conducts RNAi, which results in the degradation of transcripts, newly made transcripts corresponding to that sequence. And this allows one to knock down or knock out the function of the gene very rapidly. That process, of course, being used in many, many systems now, was discovered in C. elegans. And so this sort of way of doing instant gene knockouts means that, in addition, we have a trick that allows us to very quickly knock out essentially every gene. Sorry? It was actually observed first in plants, but it was not, the observation called post-suppression was not known to be RNAi. So RNAi was observed first in C. elegans, because that's those are the guys who named it. But I think there's going to be a prize that will be shared with plant people. So plants came first, I guess. But I don't think, no one ever in the plant community took a double-stranded RNA, put it in a plant, and knocked down gene expression. So the nice thing about worms is that one can deliver the double-stranded RNA directly through their diet. Worms eat E. coli. If the E. coli express a double-stranded RNA, the worms will eat the bacteria. That double-stranded RNA will actually cross the membrane, spread throughout the entire animal, knock down the function of the gene corresponding to that particular sequence. And so what this means is one can perform a genome-wide screen almost as easily as one can perform culturing of C. elegans. And of course, it was selected because it's easy to culture. For the 20,000 or so genes in C. elegans, there is a library that's been made available by Julie Erringer's lab in Cambridge, representative of, actually, it's almost the full genome. And that library simply means you can take worms, feed them on each of the clones from that library, and you effectively can knock out each gene across the entire genome. And it's almost as easy as simply feeding them and then looking what happens. So that really sets us up in a great position for systems-level functional analysis of gene activity. And that's one of the major directions that we're now taking in my lab. So this just summarizes the screening method. I won't go through that right now. At a systems level, we think that we'll learn a lot about human biology, and of course this is good for NIH funding, blah, 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 but it certainly is that C. elegans is a good model for a number of human diseases. There are a number of diseases being studied with this creature. And I think I'll skip over this point. This is some of the things that C. elegans has contributed to uniquely, and I'll pass over that. But I'm always surprised to find, for example, people working in mammalian systems that know about caspases but don't know that caspases were discovered because of a mutation in C. elegans. So these other processes, microRNAs, RNAi, et cetera, were developed using the system. So it's a very attractive system for a lot of experimental approaches.
Joe, sorry. So is knocking down as easy as feeding cells, does it mean, for example, that you can study epistasis by feeding a mixture of E. coli?
Yeah, when we do epistasis experiments, and I probably won't talk about Tim's experiment, for example, generally you can't just mix two bacteria. So if you're doing a double or triple, you can do triple RNAi's, even four, starting to push it. But generally when you do that, you do it by microinjection, which is not that difficult, given that it's usually one experiment you want to do.
So therefore it's not as easy as feeding the...
Well, at least for anyone.
Why if it works for one and doesn't work for two?
I don't know. I have no idea why when you... And this is in the lore. We really haven't pushed it in my lab at all, but it's in the lore that if you try to mix two bacteria, it does not work well. And it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it should work just fine. So I don't know why that would be. That's just the observation. You know, biologists are superstitious, right? We're deeply superstitious scientists, rather than rational. We are totally irrational scientists. And if you hear something doesn't work, or it doesn't work for you a few times, you know, and you don't want to spend months trying to figure out how to get it to work or whatever, if you could have another method. So, yeah, I don't know.
So the feeding technique works sort of for more adult or somewhat later stage of things, or
you can do it at any stage that they eat.
Okay, but
in fact, we do screens
in that picture.
You can affect genes. You can alter the expression of genes that act at the very first cell cycle because you feed the mother.
Okay.
Or you can affect any of these processes. This is embryogenesis to here. Here's where worms hatch.
Right.
But any of these later events, this is larval development through here. You can affect those if the gene is responsive to RNAi by interfering earlier on. In
do all cells take up RNA?
Yes. So, neurons maybe, probably all cells take it up. Certainly all the cells that you can assay by RNAi are affected by double-stranded RNA delivered to one cell. You can inject RNA into one cell and the entire animal will be affected. There is a transport system that delivers small interfering RNAs, 21 nucleotide chunks that are dissected down from the large double-stranded RNA, and that spreads through the entire animal. There's a whole transport system that's been explored. Yeah.
So C. elegans doesn't have any sort of defense mechanism against viruses, or it's not?
Well, this is probably one of them. RNAi is probably a defense mechanism against virus. There is a very primordial immune system as well, mostly antibacterial. But this appears to be a system in part to protect against, for example, the movement of transposons, which one can think of as kind of like virus-like pieces. If you look at mutants that are defective in RNAi, why am I pointing to that? Then you find transposition occurring at much greater rates. Okay, so RNAi is a way to kind of keep transposons at bay, probably viruses as well. Is there something else in your question that I'm not getting?
No, I'm still thinking about Boris' question about why it would work if you give it a mixture of two different mutants.
Only in feeding experiments. It does work if you inject two RNAs from a solution. It does work fine. So why feeding does, you know, it may just be that we haven't worked out conditions to make sure the bacteria grow at very even rates on the plates. You know, it's potentially trivial. I wouldn't want to make a big deal of it. It's just that in practice, we and other people
don't
do it.
Okay, can spread of the RNA saturable? So
that
when you work,
no, but I don't think that's the problem, because if you inject two double-stranded RNAs into one cell in the animal, you can get the effect throughout the whole animal. It's just something about the way we grow among bacteria. It's probably trivial.
And
I wouldn't make a big
deal. Amplified. That's why it's spread.
It's being amplified. In fact, Fire and Mellor, who first discovered RNAi, showed that in fact, I think as few as they calculated 3 molecules or 5 molecules per nuclei are enough to completely eliminate thousands of transcripts within that cell. So it is definitely catalytic. There's obviously a replication step involved. Some of the proteins that are involved in RNAi are known to be RNA-dependent RNA polymerases, for example. So there's obviously an amplification process. Okay, so now let me get on to apoptosis. Okay, so in the cor- if you look at the development of the animal, one of the things you see, which somebody brought up, very strikingly, is lots of cells that were born only just to die within 20 minutes, for example. And in fact, John Sulston discovered that when he was following cell lineages. That was the first observation that indicated that cells seem to have a program in advance. They anticipate this way in advance to know that they're going to die. And so if you look at a particular part of a lineage, this is part, a lot of the nervous system is made from this little chunk of lineage. If you blow it up, what you see is all these red dots, which are covering up little X's, which means that those are cells that, 20 minutes after they were born about, undergo cell death, as shown here. That's a cell corpse. That's a cell corpse. Those cells were alive just half an hour ago. They would have looked like completely normal cells. And you can see there's a lot of cell death that occurs in this animal. I said 959 cells are born in the course of development, and those are the ones that live. Another 131 cells are born and then die. So the total number of nuclei made in the soma of this animal is actually 1,090. 131 of those cells undergo programmed cell death in an absolutely reproducible fashion, and plus or minus a couple of minutes in either direction. So if you went to New Zealand and picked the C. elegans out of the soil, you would find exactly the same pattern of cell death. It's possible to get mutants that completely eliminate cell death. If you get mutants at the right time in the history of your life, you'll get a Nobel Prize, as Bob Horvitz did for discovering the core genes involved in apoptosis. So Bob's lab, Hilary Ellis in particular, found one mutation initially in a gene called SED3, which completely eliminates the cell death program. Those worm mutants, are fully viable. They have 1,090 cells. Otherwise, they're pretty healthy. And the analysis of that gene and many others since then have led to the description of a pathway, a genetic pathway, that controls the process of life or death in this animal. That pathway starts with, I'm going to greatly simplify this, there are more than 20 genes or so that have been described by Horvitz's lab that are involved in this process, and we've identified many more, over 100. So I'm just going to give you the bare bones of this. But we think of the process
really
start.
Is it correct in every sense that a cell, a worm that doesn't have any programmed cell death, mm-hmm. is perfectly normal?
Right. So I hope I didn't say perfectly normal. I did. They look perfectly normal on plates. Their brood sizes are normal. If we stick to SED3 now for a minute, there's no observable phenotype. They're the same size, as far as I know. I don't think anybody's been done careful morphometric analysis, but they seem to be about the same size. The only thing that I'm aware of that SED3 mutants are defective in addition to killing those 131 cells, is that their IQ is pretty low. So if you put them through intelligence tests, they fail dismally. Worms have memory. The nervous system's not functioning properly. Worms have memory. They can remember things for 3 days, way longer than I can. And so, and in fact, they don't do, if you actually ask these guys, the SED3 mutants, to remember things, they're pretty bad at it. So there's no doubt in my mind that if you knock this gene out and you throw a worm out in the soil, you're not going to find any babies the next spring, for sure. So there's
something about that. You're saying not in lab conditions.
Lab conditions, we're giving them everything.
Right.
They're swimming in their food. Worms that are completely paralyzed, that have no muscle function, grow up under lab conditions. Worms that have no nervous system function grow up. And we're giving them everything. They're on IVs, essentially. So it's not a fair thing to ask.
Do worms get cancer? It's probably very stupid.
Actually, worms get tumors. They don't get metastatic cancers, although I think we're hoping that we can create a model for metastasis, and there are some models developing now. They certainly get tumors. Where they get tumors, though, the only place that tumors have been seen is in the germline. The germline divides through a sort of an uncontrolled process. There's no set lineage. Unlike the soma, the germline just divides and divides and divides. So the controls that are constraining cell division in the soma are not affecting the germline, and so that's probably why it's possible to get mutations in genes that cause germline tumors. And we're actually doing some work, Pradeep in my lab, postdoc in my lab, doing some work with one of a couple of the most famous tumorigenic genes in the animal. By the way, C. elegans has P53. We published some stuff on that. I was going to talk about P53 today, and I decided I probably can't slip it in, so I'm going to just focus on cell death. But if anybody's interested in talking about that afterwards, we can get together and talk about what P53 does for worms. Okay. So here's the core cell death pathway again. The first gene ever identified any animal that is required for cell death is called SED3. It encodes what we now are fondly calling caspases. These are cysteine proteases that are present throughout the animal kingdom and involved in activating apoptosis. In humans, there are caspase cascades. These things act in cascades in pathways, probably partly to provide for amplification. And those cascades result in the ultimate demise of the cell through apoptosis. In the same screen that identified SED3, the gene SED4 was identified. SED4 gives the same phenotype as SED3, so you can build a simple linear pathway, as I'll show you, and then I'm going to describe the fact that the pathway doesn't look so linear, thanks to work from Tim Bloss in my lab. SED4, I'll show you how this works in a minute, the vertebrate equivalent is called APAF1. It's required to activate the SED3 caspase. So these guys are involved in execution of cells. They're essential for cell death. They trigger the program. And it is true, it seems to be the case that these proteins are present in all cells, all neurons anyway, perhaps all cells, poised on the edge of killing cells. Probably all cells have the capacity to activate this pathway of programmed cell death. So it's also therefore critical that one keeps this switch off and this switch into death. And one of the major questions that we're interested in approaching, and that we're starting to approach, is what is the complex network, what is the machinery, what's the structure, the architecture of that machinery that allows for that switch to be robustly turned on or kept off? What is, how is the structure of that switch built to make sure that it's off when it needs to be and on when it needs to be? So one important part of that switch is a protein that prevents the execution pathway from coming on. SED9, gene discovered in C. elegans, is the equivalent of human BCL2. Named for its role in B cell lymphomas. SED9 is a protein that keeps this machinery off. Mutations in SED9 result in extra cell death, too much cell death, because this program is activated. So SED9 is a protector against cell death. The human equivalent was named because rearrangements of this gene caused it to be hyperactivated or dysregulated in a way that cells that should die in the lymph system do not die. And that results in particular kinds of lymphomas, the failure to undergo apoptosis, resulting in the lymphoma. Okay, so the way this works at a more molecular level is one has to focus on the key organelle in this decision, the one that's calling the shots, and that's the mitochondrion. SED9 is associated with the mitochondrion, and it there binds to SED4 in cells that are alive. So this is what's a very crude way of thinking about it. This is what cells that are alive look like. And when cells receive a pro-apoptotic signal, that is, in their developmental program, they get a cue that they should die, they express a protein called EGL1. This is a protein that we know can multimerize with SED9, can bind to SED9. And when it does that, it displaces SED4 from SED9, causing SED4 to diffuse throughout the cytoplasm and to activate the precursor form of SED3. SED3 is made as an inactive zymogen. SED4 released from the mitochondrion, binding to SED4, binding the precursor form of SED3 causes multimerization, autoactivation, or activation of the SED3 protein into the active caspase form shown here, and that then can trigger cell death by cleaving lots of things. So this
no role for cytochrome C
here. There is no role for cytochrome C in C. elegans that we've identified, but there absolutely is a role for mitochondria. I think cytochrome C is used in vertebrates for, at least I'd like to propose, it may be trivial reasons that it's cytochrome C per se. That is, so cytochrome C is released from mitochondria in human cells, in vertebrate cells, for example. That causes this activation process. It causes this APAP-like thing to associate with caspase and turns on what's called the apoptosome. But if simply you just have to have some protein that says, okay, the mitochondrion has released stuff, now I can trigger this, then cytochrome C would be convenient, but it's possible that whatever interface binds to cytochrome C could change over evolutionary time. And so there may well be a cytochrome C equivalent that's not cytochrome C, but another protein in the mitochondrial matrix that's released in these things. We know mitochondria are really important, as I'll
mention. Can you do this all in vitro like you can with
the This has not been reconstructed in vitro in C. elegans. We'd love to do that, and you'll see why. We have lots of proteins to work with, so we'd love to be able to do that, but we're not at that level yet. Some of the steps have been reconstructed in vitro, this activation step, for example, has. But the whole mitochondrial thing, really, we don't have a good in vitro system for that now. Okay, so that's the pathway, and one of the questions that arise, well, this thing is going around cleaving lots of targets and activating cell death. What are those targets?
ECL1 doesn't come from the mitochondria.
It is Well, that it's subcellular localization, as far as I know, has not been reported. So we don't know if it fills up the cytoplasm. It looks like the major control system is simply transcriptional. So we're coming back to transcriptional regulatory networks in C. elegans, at least, to understand what the trigger is that causes this to happen. When EGL1 is transcribed, it sets this thing in motion. Its transcription seems to be sufficient to activate this process. Okay. And so its regulatory domain is very complex. Its cis-acting regulatory domain it has a lot of transcriptional inputs because of the complex pattern of cell death in the enzyme.
Is neoalpha-1 bad in that?
Yes, it's bad. It's a BH3-only domain protein, which is bad. I don't know which of those. I don't think it's like any one of those.
It's not. So it's different. There's no alpha-1.
I don't think there's a specific alpha-1. I don't think there's a. It might be.
It's not like the whole family.
There are only two. SED13 is the other one. And as far as I know, they're kind of out on their own branch. I don't think that they're an obvious orthologue of BID or BIM or whatever.
I thought that in C. elegans transcription is pretty silent at the beginning. And therefore then, how could you regulate this echo?
Okay, I'm not sure what you may be thinking about fairly old data. So we showed in my lab about 7 years ago that there's a gene, certainly that's transcribed by I think we found the earliest transcribed gene at the four-cell stage. There's plenty of transcription that occurs by the four-cell stage. So, and that's well before any cell death occurs.
Oh, okay.
That's many cell divisions it's only a few hours before, but it's many cell divisions before any cell death. So there's tons of transcription going on shortly after fertilization. Probably transcriptionally active within the first half an hour or less.
So what is the role of mitochondria in this, aside from providing the surface for SED9?
This is a highly simplified view. So, for example, Arnie alluded to the fact that the mitochondria releases things, and cytochrome C being one of them. But we know in C. elegans there are proteins that are mitochondrial that are released from the mitochondria upon a pro-apoptotic signal. Some of those proteins go into the nucleus. Apoptosis-inducing factor and endonuclease G are both proteins that go into the nucleus and cause nuclear breakdown. They're loaded up in the mitochondria. There's probably a lot of proteins loaded up in the mitochondria that help carry out the whole program of cell suicide.
You draw this pathway, the implication is that this is a necessary pathway for apoptosis,
right.
And the rest of what mitochondria does or can do is not necessary?
Yeah, less so. To see the effects, for example, of endonuclease G or AIF, you got to set up the genetic backgrounds just right, and you're looking at fairly sensitive changes in phenotypes. So in terms of mitochondrial proteins, they're known to be absolutely essential for turning off cell death or turning on cell death. The only ones I know of in C. elegans anywhere are SED4, SED9, and some other things that I'll be talking about from work in my lab. But I think that's the tip of the iceberg. And if you mutate a gene and you see a very mild effect, that certainly doesn't mean that that protein is sort of peripherally involved. But it does mean, obviously, there's lots of redundancy in the system, which we know of. Okay. I was going to say something else about mitochondria.
No, sorry.
Is that okay?
No. I'd like to remember. I'm sort of confused. So what are the equivalents of BACs?
BACS is a SED9 like protein that acts pro-apoptotically. It's an activator of apoptosis.
Mm-hmm. So
there's not really a BACS I can't, there's nothing like that in C. elegans that we know of. There may be alternative spliced forms of SEB9 that, that haven't been well enough there.
And a minor comment, like Michael, when there seems to be sort of program cell death in yeast or cell people sort of fight about it.
Right.
And it seems like if you take human bats and sort of try to overexpress it, you can drive these cells to autophagy. I wonder whether there are many ways mitochondria is mostly trying to tell the system, and maybe in ancient time it told you about some oxidative stress or something.
Yeah, sure. So the question of whether unicellular eukaryotes really undergo apoptosis is still up in the air, but there's some pretty interesting observations about that. But that gets back to what I was going to say about mitochondria, in fact, and that is that I think this possibly could reflect an ancient killing system. It is conceivable that the very ancient mitochondria, which was a free-living bacteria, may have developed some sort of pathogenicity, right? So it actually had killing function, and the machinery that we're now using for apoptosis may have been co-opted from a primordial pathogenic killing system that bacteria at 1.3 billion years ago or so were using to invade primordial eukaryotic cells. There's been a lot of speculation on this point that, in fact, the system of apoptosis depends on mitochondria because, in fact, bacteria actually have things that can kill other cells, and they're simply exploiting those in this system.
Can you do RNAi in the mitochondria?
Not that I know of. I don't think that the double-stranded RNA gets in there. I don't know that anybody's tried that, though, rigorously. They were so focused on nuclear genes that I don't think it's been rigorously tried. But there's no evidence that I know of that it'll get into the mitochondria. Getting into it doesn't even have to get into the nucleus, but getting into the nucleus is easy because nuclear pores are big. Getting a double-stranded RNA into the mitochondria.
But not many of these proteins are nuclear genes.
Most mitochondrial proteins are encoded in the nucleus, almost all of them, even in C. elegans, even more so in humans, but plenty in C. elegans. There aren't that many encoded in.
So in modern-day C. elegans, there is no way of triggering apoptosis through a signal from the mitochondria. It always comes from outside.
Well, you mean under normal conditions, but certainly I think under aberrant conditions, we're doing that every day in the lab. As I'll describe to you, we have a lot of mitochondrial proteins that we can inactivate, and that seems to trigger apoptosis inappropriately, if that answers your question. But it doesn't seem to rely on anything other than this system, as far as we know, for triggering apoptosis under normal conditions. Okay. P53, for example, triggers apoptosis in response to DNA damage. It does so by upregulating not EGO1, but SED13, which is another BH3-only domain protein, something we actually have found recently to be the case. Okay, let me go on and say, okay, so the question is, what are the targets? What are maybe other mitochondrial proteins as the targets? Sort of setting the case up for myself. So we actually got into this question by sort of stumbling across another protein involved in preventing cells from dying. And this was work initially by Eric Witsi in my lab, and then a beautiful job done by Tim Bloss, a postdoc who's in the lab, sitting back in the back row there. And Tim and Eric found a gene that by RNAi gives a very striking phenotype. Can you guys see this stuff with this, all this light on the screen? Yeah. Okay, so here's a normal embryo. There's an apoptotic death. Here is an embryo in which its mother had the gene Ice1 inactivated by RNAi. And what you see is this embryo just fills up with cell corpses. Almost everywhere you look, you get a cell corpse. So it's called a starburst phenotype, often referred to. Massive cell death going on here. That massive cell death corresponds to massive loss of cells, not surprisingly. Here's the nervous system expressing a green fluorescent protein marker. There are about 300 cells in here, a little under 300 cells in the brain of the animal. And in these mutants, sometimes so many neurons are lost that you can make out individual neurons that are remaining behind. There's probably just a few dozen in this particular animal. It's hard to find these guys this good, but in any case, this really looks like a clear case of a neurodegenerative disease in a worm that occurs over a matter of a few hours, actually. Now, finding a protein that, when one eliminates it, you get lots of cell death is not necessarily interesting, but it becomes more interesting if, for example, that protein is able to turn off the normal program. So if that protein can shut down the system, when its expression is forced in cells that normally wouldn't be expressing it, then maybe this looks like it actually is something to do, has something to do with the control circuitry here. And that appears to be the case, actually, don't worry about the data, but basically, if TIN expresses IF1 throughout the whole animal, including in cells that would normally be programmed to die, instead of getting this histogram, he sees a histogram shifted to lower numbers of cell corpses. He can find cases where nearly every cell death in the animal, at least in a particular organ, was blocked by overexpressing this protein ICE1, which, by the way, stands for inhibitor of cell death, gene 1. Okay, so this protein seems to be necessary to keep cells alive and sufficient to turn off the normal apoptotic program, perhaps indicating it is part of a switch. Yeah?
How localized is it to the neurons?
How localized is the protein to the neurons?
This mutant affecting...
No, oh, I'm sorry, it's not at all. It isn't at all. I just showed you that as one example. It looks like it's affecting tissues, even lineages that never undergo cell death. The endoderm, one cell divides to 20 cells during the development of the endoderm. You never see any cell death occurring. We see, Tim sees cell death occurring in these mutants in the endoderm. So it looks like it's required to probably protect all cells from dying.
Is it IAP?
Nope. IAPs don't seem to... So they're really important in flies. Kind of so important in... They don't seem to do much in worms. We haven't been able to link IAPs to cell death. It seems to be a really arthropod-specific thing, I think.
But there was
this is definitely not an IAP. Yeah, so I'll let's see. Am I there yet? Okay, here it is. Here's the homolog. So ICE1 is the worm homolog of what is called Mason Chain-Associated Complex, or NAC, described in mammalian cells. This gets a little weird because NAC was originally identified through in vitro studies that implicated it in protein targeting processes. Inhibition of translocation of ER-bound proteins and promotion of translocation of mitochondrial proteins. So at least there's some kind of link to the mitochondrion. We don't really understand how it might be involved in protein targeting. In fact, I'm not yet convinced that it really that ICE proteins are really involved in protein targeting in vivo. The evidence in yeast has fallen. There hasn't been good evidence for in vivo roles in yeast. But one thing that's striking is that after we found this, Tim just stumbled across the literature. There's a paper that had been published not too long before that showed that beta NAC, the beta subunit, and this is the equivalent of the beta subunit of this two subunit protein, beta NAC is eliminated in early in apoptosis of a couple of different cell lines. So if you just do 2D gels, it's a prominent spot that disappears within a few hours. So it's sort of an immediate early response to apoptosis in those cells. And it was subsequently shown in another study that beta-NAC is cleaved by caspase 3. But those were just sort of correlative observations. The functional consequences of that were not appreciated at the time. But Tim has taken up this observation and said, okay, well, does ICE1, which is an apoptotic suppressor, does it get cleaved by a caspase, which leads you to start to think of how it could fit into this process. And within ICE1, this is the human and the C. elegans protein lined up, there is, so there's a caspase cleavage site right there in the human protein, the cleavage is right after that aspartate. There's a different sequence in the C. elegans protein, completely different except for the aspartate, but that sequence, LGPD, is a good caspase cleavage target, actually, they're, based on substrate specificities. This site, you can think of the caspase site being conserved, even though the exact sequence isn't conserved. And Tim took ICE1 and just expressed it in vitro, incubated it with some SED3 protein from Ding Xu's lab, and lo and behold, that SED3 cleaves it perfectly fine. Here's full-length ICE1. He gets a smaller size, and it could be interpreted as being cleavage at that site I showed you in the last slide. And he also sees evidence for cleavage process, a progress, and a product in vivo. It is wild type. This is just taking total worm gamish from all stages, probably mostly larval and adult worms, running them out on a Western doing using ICE1 antibody. You can see a large protein and a cleavage product, and he does not see that cleavage product in mutants that are defective in cell death, SED3, SED4, or EGL1. And so that's consistent with this cleavage occurring in vivo in a way that's dependent on the core machinery. Okay, I'll skip this point. I will mention that ICE1 is in the mitochondria. That's kind of gratifying. Here it is in embryos, co-localizing in green with this red mitochondrial stain in the merge. So it looks like most of the protein is in mitochondria. And so we're imagining that ICE-1 somehow acts with its machinery to prevent activation of the cell death pathway, but as I said, it looks like it's downstream of the caspase, which as far as we know is not at the mitochondria, so we've got to sort of sort this out. But we have some other evidence that ties ICE-1 to the core pathway. So first of all, ICE-1 is mitochondrial, as I said. ICE-1 actually requires this protein, SED9, to be mitochondrial. So if you look at mutants that lack SED9, ICE-1 goes from the mitochondrion, the mitochondria here, to the nucleus. You get rid of SED9, ICE-1 becomes nuclear. So that's kind of suggested that ICE-1 and SED9 are interacting with each other, or at least maybe part of a some sort of relationship in a complex. And also in SED9 gain of function mutants, so these are mutants that you can just think of these as being hyperactive because they hold on to SED4, they become resistant to EGL1 knocking SED4 off, so they never let go of SED4. And in those mutants, curiously, so in those mutants you don't get any cell death because SED4 can't ever go away from SED9. And in those mutants, ICE1 is constitutively localized to the mitochondrion. So early in embryogenesis, it turns out that ICE1 is actually a nuclear protein. It's not mostly mitochondrial, it's nuclear. But in these gain-of-function mutants, when you have too much SED9 that doesn't let go of SED4, the protein is always mitochondrial. It never goes into the nucleus. So it looks like SED9 is necessary and sufficient for ICE1 localization to the mitochondrion. And so that certainly suggests it plays with the core apoptotic pathway. And now as geneticists, we can also ask, well, are these components of the core apoptotic pathway required for the cell death that is seen when one eliminates ICE1? And the answer is yes and no. So here's the yes. So this is looking at the amount of cell death you see when you get rid of ICE1 in a wild-type animal. Lots of cell death occurs. You see tons of cell death. In a SED4 mutant animal, you get essentially no cell death. So SED4 is essential for the apoptosis we're seeing when ICE1 is missing. You would think SED3 would be, nice linear pathway that I showed you, SED3 has no effect on the cell death you see when ICE1 is eliminated. That was a very shocking result. First time that I know of that SED3 and SED4 function have been separated. And so one of the questions we faced is to figure out why does the cell death occur in the absence of SED3? How can the cell death occur without SED3 around? SED3 is the critical regulator of cell death, or so it was thought. And we imagined, well, SED3 is just acting redundantly with other caspases. There are three other caspase-encoding genes in the C. elegans genome, encoding six different proteins because of differential splicing. So we simply proposed that maybe under our conditions anyway, SED3 and these other caspases are acting redundantly. We can test that by turning off all caspase activity. This is a viral protein, an insect viral protein, P35, that binds to caspases and shuts them off. And so Tim asked, well, okay, if we shut off all caspases, what happens to the cell death we see in ICE1 mutants? And the answer is, you shut off that cell death very dramatically.
But this P35 could have all other kinds of effects.
It could be doing something completely different. Its only role, its only activity known from biochemical and structural studies, is to bind caspases and serve as essentially a suicide substrate. This does not prove that a caspase is involved, but certainly but we have other evidence that this cell death is caspase dependent. So we interpret this experiment to mean that the cell death we're seeing is caspase dependent. Okay, but there are other alternative explanations. But we have other evidence that cell death is caspase dependent because if you get rid of the function of one of these three other caspases by RNAi, CSP1, you can see that drives down the cell death, not to the SED4 level, but this is RNAi. RNAi is never absolute. There are other caspases. We don't know if we notch out a bunch of them together, if that would take care of the rest of that. But certainly, this shows the involvement of another caspase in cell death in C. elegans, which hadn't been known before. And it also leads us to postulate a model for the way the cell death machinery is activating cell death in C. elegans. It's a little twist on what I showed you before. So imagine that we still have this core pathway that I described earlier. But SED3's job is to do something a little different from what was originally proposed. We imagine that SED3 actually acts on ICE1 by cleaving it, and I showed you evidence for that in vivo, in vitro. It cleaves ICE1, eliminating its function as a repressor of a caspase, CSP1. So what we have is we have ICE1 acting downstream and upstream of caspases. It's sort of sandwiched in between the two. We imagine SED4 is required to activate both of these. That's why if you get rid of ICE1, the cell death that you see caused by hyperactivation of this protein is still SED4 dependent. So the epistasis looks kind of screwed up. The epistasis would suggest SED4 is downstream, but if the pathway split, SED4 mutations would act upstream. Okay? SED3 mutations would not have an effect on cell death because the function of that protein is simply to get rid of this one. You get rid of SED3, it's irrelevant. That, getting rid of ICE1 is enough. It doesn't matter whether you have that or there or not. So ICE1 then represses CSP1, and then in the absence of ICE1, CSP1 takes over and kicks on cell death. And we can look at this further. We don't have evidence for this yet, but if ICE1 were a general repressor of caspases, we don't have evidence for that yet, but if it were, and there's a little bit of reason to think that it might inhibit SED3 activity, then this may create a little bit of a feedback, in a sense, a positive feedback loop, which is to say a repressor of cell death is cleaved by the protein that it represses. Okay, so this is a positive feedback loop that takes you from an all or none, that creates an all or none switch, in a sense. And we'd like to dissect this switch further to find out if this is right, and if it is, to see if it behaves as one would predict in this kind of switch. Does it show sort of hysteresis that one might see in a switch of that type?
So when do you think it comes off SED9, ICD1?
So it may, we don't know if it comes off SED9, actually. We really don't know in a EGO1 mutant. Well, let's see. In an EGO1 mutant, we would predict that it might be constitutively mitochondrial. So EGO1 may actually be sufficient to drive it off of SED9. That may be sufficient to do that. So it may be acting in parallel. I don't think there's anything inconsistent with that. But we don't know. But we don't know in normal cell death that it does come off.
It inhibits these caspases while it's bound to SED9.
So we don't know where these things are localized in cells, I should say. I said that SED3 was free in the cytoplasm. We really don't have evidence for that. But we would also imagine, I'll leave it at that. But the problem is we have some holes in where we know proteins are. So there's nothing to say that actually these caspases aren't also at the mitochondria. And the sort of standard model is that they're not, but I don't think there's any evidence that they're not. So they may be all held together in a complex of the mitochondria. Okay, I'm going to skip this part.
Does the drug that inhibits caspase work in lunch?
Like ZDAD and... I can't think of anybody who's used it.
That would be generalized inhibitor caspase.
Yeah, P35 is used in a lot of systems anyway, so...
I'm just thinking that that gets over the... Right. Just begins to get over the objection.
Right.
P35 is doing something else by the time you're finished.
Yeah.
Inhibitors, you bound to
right.
Some specificity.
That's right.
But this is like an IAP session. That's the IAPs are going to be
captured. Well, IAPs, but they're doing it through the proteasome system. Could this be acting through proteasome? I guess it's possible that it's substituting for an IAP. Could be, yeah. We don't know at what level it's inhibiting. We're thinking it's inhibiting conversion to the active form, but not destabilizing it. But we can look at all this stuff. Now, these are not tough experiments to do. We can do the biochemistry. We don't have any answers on it yet. But those are questions we can certainly answer. Okay, so I'm out of time. Should I talk a little bit about network stuff or just?
Sure.
Okay. All right. This is sort of a systems thing, I guess. So let me just tell you a little bit about our work starting from this standpoint. So really work through a whole network to do some systems biology analysis on cell death. And of course, because of this high throughput genomic screening possible for us, we can take a systems approach. And we've done that. And so Tom McCloskey in the lab in particular was sort of the pioneer in the screens to identify more genes involved in apoptotic suppression using the following rationale. So SED9 mutants show too much cell death. Get rid of the protector, too much cell death. If you make a double with SED9 and SED3, you get no cell death because the hyperactivation of cell death in a SED9 mutant is dependent on this caspase. ICE1 mutants show the same phenotype except that SED3 does not suppress that phenotype. Right? because of the, and I put a model forth to account for that difference. But that behavior means it's actually fairly straightforward to look for more genes that would act like ICE1. One just looks for the presence of cell death in a mutant that otherwise shouldn't have any cell death. You start with a SED3 mutant, never has any cell death, and you simply look when you do an RNAi for embryos, this is supposed to be embryos, that start to fill up with cell corpses. In the, even though you don't have SED3 around. Normally there's no cell death in the absence of SED3. You do RNAi on a particular gene. If you get one like this, you've got another ICE1-like gene. So Tom has performed a screen like that using RNAi screening tools that I mentioned. Basically, you just feed worms on this library, and you just look for that phenotype. And he's got a lot of genes coming out of this screen, a lot of interesting stuff pouring out. This is a collection of 80 genes. This number is jumping around because he's refining the screen and so forth. But of course, because we have a whole genome sequence, we immediately, you know, the instant you look at the microscope, you go to the computer, and 2 minutes later, you know what protein it is that's causing that de-repressed cell death phenotype. And so we know that there's a collection of proteins that, when inactivated, give this SED3 independent cell death phenotype. And the distribution of proteins seems to reflect the gamut of protein coding, not a huge gamut, a limited gamut. It reflects a relatively small number of protein types. We have, actually this is out of date, I apologize, but a relatively small number of biochemical motifs. We're not getting everything in the cell that when inactivated gives too much cell death. We're getting a targeted set of things. In particular, this was striking to us, we get a bunch of proteins that are mitochondrial. We knock out these mitochondrial proteins, we activate the cell death pathway, independent of SED3. Now Tom has been dissecting these further. He's found that some are dependent on SED4, some are not dependent on SED4. So there looks like there's different parts of the pathway that he's able to dissect apart with this approach. And he's found, so I had predicted that maybe what he's seeing when he gets some mutants like this, where there's a few cell corpses in a mutant that's otherwise SED3 minus, it may be the case that in fact what you've done is just completely elevated the apoptotic program a huge amount, much more than you're seeing here. There might be a lot of SED3 dependent cell death and a little bit of SED3 independent cell death, and I can't go through the whole rationale that way right now, but in fact that's the case. He's found some genes that if he looks at RNAi in a wild type background, then he gets whopping levels of cell death, much more than he got in the original screen. So these are massive cell death suppressors that depend largely on SED3 for the cell death that's seen.
Well, yes? I didn't understand how it experiment was done. In what sense is it high throughput? It looks to me like 80 different experiments.
It is high. So those, no, that's about 3,000 different experiments. It turned up 80 genes that give that phenotype.
But okay. How are they done in parallel?
You grow a lot of worms on a lot of plates at once.
But then you look at them one by one? Or?
You look at them by one. You have to screen them one by one. That's true. So it's high throughput relative to any other system you can do for dissecting genetically a process like this. Okay. Now, if you mean massively parallel, but you could do that. You could automate this, for example. If that's your definition of high throughput, then I guess this isn't high throughput. But using this kind of approach, it's been possible to speed up gene discovery, the association of a gene with a phenotype, about at least 1,000-fold compared to the old-fashioned way of looking for mutants and cloning genes. So 1,000-fold is a lot higher throughput than 1-fold. So can you call that high throughput? Or
do I have to know? I just don't understand how the experiment is done.
It's just done with plates, and it's so it's...
Right, so you have the library of your... RNAs,
right,
that you grow 3,000 plates,
right,
and then you prepare 3,000 slides, and
right, that's right.
But you don't have 3,000 students.
That's right. Well, but doing 3,000 slides is something that a guy like Tom, who's a very good graduate student, can do in 6 months or less. Actually, now he'd do it in probably a third that time.
And you deconvolute the RNA that was in the bacteria, or you keep the bacteria separate. You just have a culture of bacteria,
yeah,
that has all the different siRNAs.
No, this is a library.
It's a library.
Every bacterial clone expresses a unique double-stranded RNA.
And
there's 18,000 clones in the library. And you feed worms on 18,000.
You have them separated.
Right, you don't need to. There's no pooling or anything like this.
Right.
Right. And I will say that I said Tom did only 3,000 or so instead of 17,000. He selected all of the lethal genes because we would predict this would give a lethal phenotype. It's already known which of these genes result in lethality, sterility, etc. So that makes it possible to pare down pretty quickly if you make some guess as to what the gross phenotype of the mutant is going to be.
Across this library, what are the range and levels of repression from the RNAi's?
0 to 100. that's the truth. You mean, so some genes are not affected at all. Other genes are complete. It looks like you've knocked the gene out, and that's a gene-specific effect, having something to do both with probably the structure of the sequence, but also with when and where it's expressed. Okay. Neurons, for example, are resistant to RNAi for reasons we don't understand.
No, I mean,
in any one experiment.
I mean the specific genes.
For one gene, what's the range of inhibition?
Right, how much does it count?
You have 18,000 different, you're doing 18,000 different experiments, right? And each one's knocking down the level of a particular gene, but these things aren't 100%. This isn't like a mutation that knocks out the gene.
Right.
This is something that reduces the level.
That's right.
What the variation is and what that looks like.
For that one experiment, say. You do one RNAi experiment, or whatever, with one gene. That's what you're asking. So you can kind of attenuate the effect. You can control how strong an RNAi effect you have. We don't do this on plates so much, but if you want to do the experiment, you would do it by injecting various concentrations of double-stranded RNA. That works to give you a sort of a gradient of effects. But in any one plate, when you do this experiment, you do get quite a range of phenotypes, which is really a strong attribute of this approach, in fact. Because on that plate, you will get embryos that have been completely or almost completely inactivated for that gene, and others that barely scratched it, that have knocked it down only a tiny bit. So you actually get a range of, so it's that's actually a benefit to this.
So is that the property of feeding RNAs as opposed to microinjection?
No, they both show distribution. If you inject at very high concentrations, depending on the gene, you usually get a range. And there's a temporal aspect of that. You look in the first day, you get a weaker phenotype. Later on, you're getting a stronger and stronger phenotype. It takes time for the catalytic process to build up enough interfering RNA that all the target messages are degraded. So there's lots of parameters that control that. But typically, you get a range. It's not like just like knocking the gene out with a deletion.
Well, but the question is, let's say there's some amount for each gene,
mm-hmm.
but which it's not that.
Right.
If you keep hitting it, what's the variation between those
multiple
different genes?
Between different genes? The variance from the averages.
So let's say
the variance of the averages.
Yeah, so let's say
so 0 to 100 is what I said.
Yeah.
So for instance, what I guess what I was concerned about, you're doing 18,000 things, obviously, no one's looking at the levels in each of the 18,000 genes.
Right.
So you're wondering now I have knocked out gene A and I've knocked out gene B
mm-hmm.
through different experiments.
Right.
This guy, the apoptosis rate goes to zero.
Right.
This guy doesn't change very much.
Right.
How do you know how do you pick out the ones where the RNAi was just killing this thing by 5% and this
right.
thing by 80%?
You can't. You can't do it with RNAi. All you can do is get an initial assessment. You can't. It's not a highly quantitative kind of experiment. It's not like a microarray experiment where you can give a value to it. You can't do that unless you do a lot of experiments on that one gene. We're out there with a fishing net finding out how many fish of how many sorts there are, and what we want to do is say, how are these fish related to one another? Which is what I'll talk about in the network analysis. But we're not able to say, how big are these fish, how many teeth do they have, etc.
But something gets through will fall through the net.
Absolutely, and that's got holes in it, lots of holes. I would guess maybe half the genes just ignore the...
That's what I was asking. What are we really talking? You're talking about feeding about half the genes.
That's a wild guess. You guys want to throw out a number? You happy with half? Half. Something like that. So definitely more than 10% and definitely less than 90%. Yes. I mean, compared to taking an animal, shaking it up with a mutagen, looking for a mutant phenotype, cloning the gene, that what I just said took 7 years, and that was one gene, you know, it's pretty good. But it's not absolutely comprehensive for sure. There's no doubt you're going to miss stuff for sure.
When I have those libraries, has bacteria,
mm-hmm.
this RNA,
mm-hmm.
they have to sort of restock it every once in a while?
Frozen.
Okay. so.
It's frozen, you go back to it, it's the exact same thing it was 30 years ago, so.
Because if you let the bacteria evolve, it's over there.
Yep, that's bad news. We go back to fresh frozen all the time. That's bacteriology, which you should always do anytime you do an experiment with any kind of clone. Don't let them grow. Go back to a master always. Okay, some of the genes that came out of this then. We got some genes involved in neurodegeneration. I won't mention that, but that looks cool. We got some genes involved in cancer. I'll talk about one of these. This one actually came out really of another screen that we did, TFG. And let me tell you a little bit about TFG. TFG is a gene that is, it's named after, it's called the TRK, T-R-K, fused gene. In other words, we don't know what this thing does. But it's found in large cell lymphomas and papillary thyroid cancers to be rearranged in a number of these cancers. Rearranged meaning that there's a chromosomal translocation of TFG to some other gene. Let's forget that stuff. So here's just a list of some of the fusions that have been seen in various cancers. And I can't remember which cancer is which, to tell you the truth. But here is the human TFG gene, function unknown. In certain cancers, it's fused to TRK, that's its name, which is a neurotrophic factor receptor. ALK is a particular type of kinase, and it's fused at various points. It's always fused in-frame, always makes an in-frame protein. So one is selecting for, presumably, this part of TFG in the form that's associated with, in the oncogenic form of this protein. These things do act as oncogenes. You can get them to transform cells. Here's a transcription factor. This is a nuclear hormone receptor called NOR1, and you see a fusion with that. So they're not all kinases. These guys are kinases. This guy isn't. So TFG is fused to a bunch of different proteins in these cancers. What the heck is going on there? So from our screen, what we postulate is that TFG is causing cancer because it's turning off cell death. And in fact, Ling Chen, who's done this work on TFG now, has found that TFG at high copy shuts off the cell death program. So this protein, like ICE1, is sufficient to turn off cell death. And so our idea is that, of course, we know that when cells start to get into trouble and are turning into a potential tumor, that activates the cell death program. Whoops. It activates the cell death program through things like P53 and lots of other goodies. And so we imagine this fused form of TFG maybe makes it a hyper-suppressor of apoptosis, allowing this thing to turn into a tumor. This is exactly the same sort of strategy that BCL2 has used to cause B-cell lymphomas. Obviously, we haven't proven this yet, but this is certainly, I think, a good postulate. If it's true, it means, you know, you kind of grow worms on plates and you figure out the mechanism of potentially the mechanism of a cancer gene. At least that's what we'd hope. Okay, so let me just tell you, should I stop or should I stop? Okay. We've done a few other screens that I won't talk about, but let me just say these are also screens designed to identify other components of the apoptotic machinery. These screens all identify overlapping sets of proteins. But what we want to do is, okay, when you do these screens, you get sort of overwhelmed. Wow, we have been able to say, okay, TFG is involved in regulating apoptosis and it's associated with cancer, et cetera, et cetera. How do we put all these together in a coherent picture? And this is where we really want to understand this at a systems level, at least one definition of systems. So what we've done, we've collaborated with Ambush Singh on campus here and Kelly Tsai and some students in my lab from electrical and computer engineering, actually. Some students in Embry's lab have worked together to try to take a computational approach to this problem. We've got a whole bunch of genes that come out of a screen. Let's see if we can take advantage of the vast amount of experimental data that are already out there in the databases and see if we can figure out how these genes are related to one another to some extent. Now, this is a very crude relationship. This is not mechanistic. It's not epistasis at this point. But at least it tells us something about the interrelatedness of these things. This is a first pass so that ultimately we'll be able to put together a logical systems view of this process. And so what we've done is used what are called the Bayesian network calculations, computations, taking data, a bunch of different database sources. These are unrelated, we hope, independent database sources, information about the that is to say, the set of protein-protein interactions that have been mapped out for C. elegans, that interactome is growing all the time, information about where the genes are positioned on chromosomes. It turns out in C. elegans has given us one of many, many gifts, or one of many gifts it's given us, is that genes are functionally clustered in C. elegans. You find that genes that are related to one another very often, sometimes, are near each other. You get little clusters of 2 to 5 genes that where those genes have something to do with one another. So positions on the genome can tell us something about the relationship between genes with one another. And let's see, I won't go through that. We use microarray expression analysis. There's now 16,000, 14,000, somewhere in there, microarray experiments that we have done with worms, and the number's going up exponentially, I think. So there's lots and lots of expression information. You can look for co-regulation of genes under any circumstance and infer something about that. Information about the subcellular localization that you know or predict, and so forth. And if you do all this and use a method developed by these guys to predict a network with some modifications done by Ambish's group, you can come up with a likelihood ratio that simply says how related any two proteins are to one another across these various databases. And you can generate from that a value for the minimum spanning tree for a collection of proteins. So all this minimum spanning tree means is the sum of the shortest relationship distances between each of the genes in the collection. So you can think of this as the shortest number of degrees of separation there are between any two proteins. Like with all of us, the shortest degrees of separation in terms of our genetic inheritance, our families, is whatever. I don't know if it's how many different ways we have to go to connect with one another. But that's really what we're looking at, how related all these are based on their behavior in these databases. So if you take a set of about 100, somebody, question?
Sorry. So you are actually trying to write down something that is fully connected, that things did not break up into different pieces.
Well, maybe they'll break up into different pieces as well. We want to find out what connections are there with the genes we identify and with other genes that we haven't identified. That's the first pass. If they're broken up, that's okay. At least we're getting
but
some.
But the minimum spanning tree, one connected piece, or actually?
Yeah, actually, it has to be, yes. So right, so everything will be connected ultimately. Right. You have to draw a threshold. You're right. So we're just adding up the total number of connections. If you go way, way down the list, you're still going to be able to find a connection. It's just going to have a really low value.
So
we're for this calculation, we're getting all connections. Okay?
He's basically doing single linkage clustering until he gets one connected component.
Right, okay.
For this calculation, that's right. Then we're going to look for a network. We're going to impose a threshold to look for a network.
So how would you have some score for any two parts have a score for how lucky they're
right, right.
Then you have to decide on some sort of cutoff.
Right. Where the cutoff is? Actually, for this, I'm not sure where, Chawei, where was the cutoff? How was the cutoff set for this?
It's 0.01. And actually, the spanning tree distance is for only the 121 gene.
Right. Oh, that's true. It's not all genes.
It's not
that's
for
right.
all the genes.
But this tree is being written on the fully connected cluster of all genes?
Of all the genes you put in. Of all the genes you put in.
Rather than on
parents.
Some kind of.
Okay, just on pairs, but not on.
Well, you can make the fully connected graph so all pairs have a bond for it, and then you can just draw a spanning tree on that.
Yeah, isn't that right? Yeah.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. One can draw it.
Yeah, Chawei can help with this, I think. So
how would one go about falsifying this? So suppose.
Let me present the data first, and then we can falsify. Is that okay? Let me just show you that. But at least it looks like it's going somewhere, you know. So okay. So this is we take 100 genes. This is about 100 genes selected randomly from the database of all genes, and you do that 100 times, and you calculate the minimum spanning tree, and you get a distribution for those 100 sets of 100 genes each, and that distribution has a certain median value. And the cool thing is, if you take the 100 genes that Tom got from his screen. And the screen hasn't even been refined yet, so some of these are false positives for sure. He finds a value for the minimum spanning tree that is 6 standard deviations away from the mean of this. So it looks like this is telling us something about the interrelationship between these genes we're getting from the screen. That was not necessarily the case. You know, all we're looking for is cell death occurring in cells that it shouldn't occur in. There could be a million different ways that can happen using very disparate parts of the cell. this suggests that, in fact, that isn't true, that there's some coherence to this data set, this functional gene set that we're
getting. This is out of that 80?
This is the, this was actually 100. It was before it was refined down to 80.
Okay, but you're not sticking this in some way by the back door, because, so what genes went into the Bayesian network or the Bayesian ratio?
It was like, here, okay, all of the genes we got from our screen.
No. What to determine this the likelihood ratio between any pair?
Uh-huh.
You had location.
Oh, what were the different? Yes.
Right. Microarray experiments.
Right. Interactome, protein-protein interactions.
Okay, but I mean.
Protein localization. Something called phylogenetics.
They all had a lethal phenotype, right?
All of these had a lethal, so we tested it, actually, that was one concern. Not all of these had a lethal phenotype. We also started with a chromosome 1 set, just for convenience. We had a chromosome 1 set. We included those as well. So we're worried, oh, well, chromosome 1 set plus lethal phenotype, we're biasing the data. We tested for that. That appeared not to be the case. There was a little bit of influence from gene location and from embryonic lethality, but it wasn't a strong effect. It didn't count for this entire difference.
So these are sets where you took 100 random genes out of the 18,000.
Yeah.
Okay, so you might worry that if you just say out of your 80 genes, if 5 of them were actually part of the same network in some specified way, and the
right.
other 75 were just
right.
totally unrelated, that would put you 6 standard deviations away.
Right. So right. So when we set I don't know if that's, would that be enough, you think, quantitatively, Chao-Wei, if 5 genes from the cluster were very strongly related, would drive this all the way to 6 standard deviations away? Do you know quantitatively if it would be enough?
I don't think so.
You don't think it'd be enough? Okay, you guys can argue about it. All right, but if we set a threshold for the relationships, and then we just draw out a very crude map. We draw out a presumed network where the red dots are the ones we picked from our screen and the white dots are other genes that we didn't get from our screen. We actually get a coherent network, in this case 61 candidate genes clustering with another 334. When we do this with the random sets, we simply don't see this level of clustering. I think the most we saw is clusters of a few red genes, 2 or 3. We don't get this massive clustering coming in. Okay, so I think that addresses your question. It's not just 5 genes that seem to be drawing these guys together. Okay.
I'm not sure I understand.
So this is simply any line between two. These are nodes which are, so the red genes are nodes that are identified from our screen. Those are genes identified from our screen. The white genes are genes that are predicted to have a significant relationship to those based on integration across this database information. A line is an edge between those two, set at a certain threshold. And obviously, if we set the threshold lower, we'll get a more complex network. Okay, so we set it at some point, we get this kind of cluster. Unfortunately, I don't have the control in my on the talk here, but if you do the controls, we never saw this kind of large-scale clustering with a random set. So I think that sort of addresses what your question is in a different way. Okay? And I can't talk about this stuff. It's cool, but I won't talk about it, and I better stop there. And let me, if anybody wants to talk more, we can. I need to thank these guys for the library, Julie Erringer's lab for the RNAi library. The work on this stuff I talked about at the end was done in collaboration with Ambush Singh and Dave Bjorn and Chao-Yi, as well as some help from these people in probability statistics. And zoom up there. Here's the group. This picture's really out of date now. I'm sorry about this. Tim Blossom is in the back of the room and is down here. Did nearly all of the work on ICE-1 I talked about, the gene originally identified by Eric Witsi in the lab, in a totally different context, actually. Tom McCloskey was involved in one aspect of the screen I told you about. Pradeep Joshi has also been carrying forth that screen. Ling Chen has worked on TFG, as I described to you. Chao-Wei Tsai also contributed to the Bayesian network calculations. Let's see, who else am I forgetting? This is terrible. I hate to, God, it's terrible to do this in front of your group. Who am I forgetting, guys? I cover everybody in this project? Okay, I think I do. All right, I think I'll stop there. Thanks.